On Friday morning, I began to think about what I should say at St. Matthew's. I looked at an email that the vicar had sent me 10 days earlier with the lections, the readings for this morning. And within 20 minutes, I had Glyn on the phone saying, I can't work out why you've chosen the readings for St. John the Baptist Day, which is in about a week's time. When his email had said, we shall just be using the revised common lectionary readings set for today. Oh, he said, that was wrong. I have just chosen the lections for today. Go ahead with those. Well, as it happens, the Revised Common Lectionary sets two alternatives for the Old Testament reading this morning. And I'm going to talk about the first one. It's actually some earlier verses in the same chapter of the first book of Samuel. It's the bloodthirsty bit that doesn't revel quite so much in the bloodthirsty bit, and you all know it terribly well. It's David and Goliath. There are two stories, familiar from our Sunday school days, familiar also perhaps from fairly common retellings, with little attention to detail or interpretation. But these two stories also offer us two dramatic narratives depicting God's powerful intrusion into the human arena to overcome the forces of injustice and chaos. The narrative of David's defeat of Goliath turns out to be much more than a fairy tale of a young lad surprising a mean giant. Lurking behind the encounter, surely, is the God who refuses to tolerate continued oppression and whose unconventional weapons for giant destruction, namely a boy too small for the appropriate outfit for battle, some stones and a sling, signify the odd ways by which God wages war against and overcomes injustice. Likewise, the plight of the disciples caught in a threatening storm and Jesus' action in bringing calm dramatize the redemptive work of God who rebukes chaotic forces and redeems beleaguered followers from a desperate situation. Modern-day disciples, only too aware of their own fear and lack of faith, can take heart from what looks like a story of rescue. But is that all it is? I think not. As Jesus stills the storm, we see again the awesome power of God. The power of God that David made much of in bringing down Goliath. And in the passage from Mark, the unpredictable and merciless forces of nature suddenly respond like obedient children to the voice of Jesus. And the disciples are amazed. They were already terrified by the storm, but they're almost equally terrified by its sudden cessation at Jesus' command. When Jesus asks them, "Why are you afraid? Have you no faith?" The gospel is deliberately unclear about which fear he refers to. Such statements of the inexorable power of God need to be heard, perhaps more today than ever, when a debilitating theology of the niceness of God can all too easily portray God as utterly ineffectual. But we have to be careful to allow God to define power and not to impose our longed-for definitions on him. The Jesus who commands the storm to cease is soon to be forced onto the cross. So how are we to understand what God's power is like? Are not the disciples as afraid of the end of the storm as of the storm itself because it has brought them up sharply against God? Give us a theory, we cry out to God, but don't give us yourself. That's more than we want. This then is the power of God, the huge generosity that fills our little outstretched begging bowls, so full that the bowl is utterly swept away in the torrent. And that's more than we bargained for. in his beautifully honest and humble little book called Basil in Blunderland, the late Cardinal Basil Hume says that for years he lived with a concept of God as a kind of gigantic teacher or policeman who would know if you sneaked into the larder and took an apple and would make sure you paid for it. The result, one might suspect, of somewhat suspect early Catholic school indoctrination. But now, many years later, he writes, I have an idea that God would have said to the small boy, take two. The gospel story of the stilling of the winds and the sea at one level is an astounding event. Did Jesus really have power over the forces of nature? Or is that the wrong question to ask? Better, perhaps, to concentrate on the meaning of the story in its context. For it takes on added significance in the recognition that the sea symbolizes throughout the Old Testament the abode of chaos. The sea is the lurking place of demons. Thus, when Jesus calms the storm, it's not merely a brute demonstration of power over nature, but a redemptive act in which the chaotic forces of the sea, like the demons, are rebuked. The miracle has a purpose in the rescue of disciples from fear and disorder. And it's no mere coincidence, then, that the language Jesus uses to calm the elements is the language of exorcism, the casting out of demons. The fact that Jesus is portrayed as uncaring and, in fact, asleep in the boat is also revealing. His own trust in God brings remarkable peace, even in the face of the storm, and contrasts dramatically with the panic of the disciples at the chaos of the sea. His sleeping, while the disciples fret, is reminiscent of the scene later in Gethsemane when the situation is reversed. Jesus frets, and the disciples sleep as if uncaring. There's a time for fretting and worrying. There's a time for sleeping. The panic shown by the disciples shows that they've not yet reached a point of profound trust. They were still unsure of just who Jesus really was. Yet they're awestruck at what he's able to do. They tremble with the fear appropriate to those who've been in the presence of God's Son, and then at least they pose the critical question, who then is this, that even the wind and the sea obey him? Well, both these biblical stories, David and Goliath and Jesus' calming of the wind and the sea, take on added significance for me in the light of my recent experience in the Anglican Communion. For it seems to me that both stories recognize those times in the life of the church when it is threatened by the forces of chaos and confusion, forces that turn out to be no match for the reign of God present in the person of Jesus. Certainly, the account of this same event in Matthew's Gospel moves clearly in this direction, a story of fearful disciples whom Jesus describes as you of little faith, and the calming and reassuring Jesus. But the Gospel stories present us not merely with the presence of Jesus, who shares our predicament amid the storms of life, but with the power of Jesus, who can do something about the storms. We're confronted not so much with a strategy for coping as with a promise of salvation, good winning out over evil, calm triumphing over chaos. As many of you will be aware, last month my term as chair of the Anglican Consultative Council came to an end at the 14th meeting of the council in Kingston, Jamaica. We met in a city that is renowned for a history of violence, coming as it has from a slave culture. Each year, the Jamaican police shoot about 400 citizens dead. If it's okay for the police, then it's okay for the citizens. It's what you do. So lots of people get shot. So that set the scene for the latest skirmish in inter-Anglican warfare. Between those who wish to see an inclusive church which lives out the primacy of love, and those who wish to see an exclusive church where some are denied full participation for a variety of reasons, and in particular on grounds of human sexuality. That, of course, is a sweeping generalization, but you might recognize from that description something of the battle that's been going on here in the New Zealand church, just as it has in the worldwide Anglican Communion and in many other Christian churches around the globe. So I've been at the helm of this fragile little Anglican boat as it has been tossed around in a number of storms. And I certainly have shared the fear of those early disciples. Will our boat be torn apart? Will we ever reach calmer waters again? Or to take the Old Testament image, can we find a David from amongst our meager resources, willing to stand up against a foe who seems to be financed from a bottomless pit of money from pretty questionable sources? We met in Jamaica against a background of unease. The last meeting of the ACC had taken place in Nottingham, in England, and had been a disaster. The representatives from the Episcopal Church in the USA and from the Anglican Church of Canada had been shut out of participation in the meeting, and the forces of the so-called Global South seemed to be in ascendant mode. A month before the Lambeth Conference last year, a large number of people had met in what was called GAFCON, the Global Anglican Futures Conference, in deliberate opposition to the Lambeth Conference. Yet the Lambeth Conference itself went ahead, and the bishops present managed to talk clearly and achieve a cohesion of mind, spirit, and understanding that started to give some encouragement to those who felt that the Anglican Communion was about to break up. Then earlier this year, the primates of the Communion had met in Alexandria and had managed to face some of the far more important issues that abound: climate change, health issues, disease pandemics amongst them. But the ACC had to make decisions on the proposed Anglican Covenant, and we were told that it was literally make or break time. The Communion learned some valuable lessons from the Lambeth Conference experience. So the ACC program deliberately built in a lot of so-called deliberation groups, where the voice of every member was listened to, and no quick decisions could be made. And that meant when we came to the sessions where decisions were to be made, there was much greater appreciation of the issues and the reasons for people taking very different positions on a number of them. In relation to the covenant, the New Zealand delegates were mindful of the majority view of this church that a covenant is not wanted. Yet we were informed of the views of many others that a covenant, as proposed, might be the only means available to us by which we can hold together as an Anglican Communion. The first three sections of the document have been worked and reworked, and the many submissions from around the Communion have been carefully listened to, and there was thus widespread acceptance of parts 1, 2, and 3. It was part 4 that caused the most debate, as it was largely new material and had received little consideration by the wider church. Although many members of the council simply wanted the ACC to put its stamp of approval on the covenant as a whole and commend it to the member churches of the Communion for adoption, there was a significant number who felt this would be premature. One of the fears was that if the document was just simply sent out, a number of what we now term breakaway groups would sign the covenant and say, "We're now the real Anglican Communion." In the end, the latter group, the group who felt that more work needed to be done, won the day. That section was sent back for some more work by a small group prior to the document as a whole being sent to each member church for consideration and possible adoption. So the ACC met well, and I was able to hand over responsibility as chair to the Bishop of Southern Malawi, who's a good personal friend, secure in the knowledge that the Anglican Communion was still largely intact and that we do seem to be sailing in slightly calmer waters. I hope that our confirmees today are able to take some comfort that the church in which they're confirming their baptismal vows is not just a small Auckland or New Zealand church, but is still part of a worldwide communion that numbers more than 80 million confirmed members. We do have our Goliaths to contend with. We have a number of storms to sail through. And we know that our help is in the name of the eternal God, who is making still the heavens and the earth, and that the Holy Spirit continues to come bearing God's gifts of grace. E te atua o te aroha noa, nau I whakarite te wai, hei tohu whānau hau, e korine e tai a te wewete. Tukoa kia tipu au pononga ki te tino kaumātuatanga, e tutuki ai I tō te karaiti. Ke hari tonu ai ki roto I a koe. Ke hira ake ai ki roto I a rātou, ngā hua o te wairua. A rātou wairua matau, marama hoki, te wairua aroha, humārie, ngāwari. He wairua hari, me te tapu porno. I won't translate that beautiful prayer. It comes directly from the confirmation service, and shortly I shall be praying it in English. As I said at the beginning, this may well be the last time that I'm in St. Matthew's as the Bishop of the Diocese. When we appointed Glenn as your vicar, I asked him to bring St. Matthew's back into the life of the Diocese of Auckland. Today I want to commend you all, and Glenn in particular, for the way you've done that. St. Matthew's continues to be a beacon of light and hope and grace for many people in this city. You make a difference, and long may you continue to make that difference. May God's holy name be praised. Amen.